offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, welcoming you from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. Thank you for joining us in that prayer session from across the globe. Usually we start this episode at 7:30, and because of this prayer session that we are planning to have in the next few weeks too, we are starting this late. So for the next 3-4 weeks, that is still Swami's Aradhana Day, the Gita series episode will start at 7:45. The duration of the program will be the same, but we'll be starting 15 minutes later. So I hope that you can make a note of that and you can join us as you always do. This is the program where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse in as much detail as possible, keeping it in the background of Swami's message. And the journey has been wonderful. We have completed 5 chapters, and last week we completed a summary of the 5th chapter. I could not complete the last few verses, and it was not a wrong idea, because the last few verses also become the basis for the 6th chapter itself. So I thought we will do the summary of those verses even before we start the 6th chapter today. So it's prayers to Swami. Let's begin this week's episode, and let me start by the summary that I promised last time. I had to cover verses 27, 28, 29, and 26, 27, 28, and 29, where 27 and 28 were one sentence. So those 4 verses were to be completed. In the 26th, Krishna speaks of a jnani as someone who is an abhito brahma nirvana vartate, for whom brahma nirvana is there either way. Abhitaha means in all sides, and it is interpreted as on both sides, ubhayataha, by Adi Shankara. Because the reference point here is, of course, death. And there are 2 sides to death, life and what happens after death. And we are speaking about Brahma Nirvana on either side of death, which means being liberated even as one is alive, or attaining the Supreme after one completes the Prarabdha and completes this lifetime. And just this Kama Krodha was mentioned in the previous verses, the verses that we had a summary of last time too. Here also Krishna describes the jnani in Kama Krodha terms. Just to refresh ourselves, Kama and Krodha, the words themselves, mean lust and anger, but these translations are not necessarily valid in the shlokas, because Kama and Krodha in this context means desire and the agitation in the mind that is born of such desires. So Krishna describes the person who is a Kama Krodha Vyuktanam, who is distant or detached from this desire and agitation couplet. Yati nam yata chetasam, a person who has made efforts and has controlled one's mind. As we saw, sometimes this shloka can be misinterpreted, as the word yati also means an ascetic, but clearly it is not given. It is understood that Krishna is trying to speak about a karma yogi, and so that meaning of the word is not appropriate here. Krishna is saying yati nam yata chetasam means a karma yogi who with effort, conscious effort, has controlled the antakarnas. Then he says viditatmanam, the one who has come to know oneself as the truth of, come to know the truth of oneself, right? Abhito brahma nirvanam vartate. Such a person is absorbed in brahma nirvana on either side. But the word abhitaha can also be translated, as I said, on all sides. And that also is valid, because it is like a suggestion that once a person has controlled the mind, controlled kama krodha, and has understood his or her nature, Brahma Nirvanam is on all sides, meaning it doesn't matter if such a person chooses sannyasa or the path of karma yoga or any other path, if there is any. It doesn't matter, because for this person, abhitaha Brahma Nirvanam. Brahma Nirvana is there on all sides. The next 2 shlokas are slightly different from the previous one. in fact, previous ones of this chapter. In the process of talking about Karma Yoga, Krishna here drops a few hints about some spiritual practices or sadhanas which are necessary and important for the sadhaka who wants to be a Karma Yogi. To be more specific, Krishna speaks about some standard techniques or exercises in meditation which can help the sadhaka. And this, as I said, becomes the introduction to the sixth chapter, which is about meditation. Krishna says, let the external sense organs remain outside. Sparshan kritva bahir bahyan. Those which are outside, the external sense objects, let them remain outside. That's what that statement means. Now, when we say senses, the senses are not merely the organs, the eyes, the ears, and the sense organs. They are pretty much part of the physical body, the physical eye and the physical ear, with all the components which go into it. They still are part of the physical body. But when we say senses, it is the physical organ plus the mental function behind those senses. So that is how they connect the physical to the mental, right? The external physical world to what is inside. That is why the senses become like the windows, and that's the analogy which is often given. So when you tell me, withdraw the senses, physically it may be easy. I can probably close my eyes, or when it comes to the ears, I can probably go away to a quiet place. I can choose not to eat certain things. These are ways by which the physical senses can probably weaned away or controlled. But controlling the senses also calls for controlling this inner faculty related to the senses. And that's what completes this act of controlling the senses. So how do we do that? Krishna gives some very beautiful simple tips in this. He says, Chakshuhu cha eva antare bruvoho. Chakshuhu cha eva antare bruvoho. And even the senses or the gaze can be turned to the point between the eyebrows. That point, which is often referred to as the Ajna Chakra, the place where the third eye or the eye of wisdom is said to be located. It's very important even in the pranic system, but if you really look at it as a physical act, you are asking me to turn my eyes inward. So this is a physical act of turning the eyes inward. You kind of concentrate at this point that is in between the eyebrows. So this is a meditation technique, how to cut off the eyes from the outside world. It's a physical activity at the same time that physical activity is attached to the faculty of seeing concentrating inward. So that is about the eyes. What about the ears? If I have to turn the sense of hearing within, how am I to do that? Prana pano, the exhalation and the inhalation, nasa abhyantara charino, that is, moving inside the nostrils, samau kritva, make them equal or make them rhythmic. So what do we do with this faculty of listening? The soham meditation, or concentrating on this breath, the inhalation and exhalation, is again one of the standard techniques in meditation. So when you say soham, we were talking about this when we were discussing this a couple of weeks back. When you say soham and Swami says that you meditate, it is not possible to say soham when you're inhaling and meditating. So it is not meant to be expressed vocally. It is meant to be heard. Even as we inhale and exhale, we hear those sounds of so and hum repeating itself. And when we do that, it's very easy for us to even try it out right away. The moment we start observing the breath in this manner, we will find that it starts becoming very calm, and it also becomes very equal. That is the time that it takes for inhalation, the time that it takes for retention, the time it takes for exhalation starts becoming equal. And that's what Krishna is speaking here. Prana pano, the exhalation and inhalation. Nasa abhyantara charino, that is, moving within the nostrils. Samau kritva, they are made equal. They are made to happen in a very rhythmic fashion. So these are the techniques among the many that are there that Krishna is offering here. And this is not necessarily a comprehensive list. He's not saying that these alone are enough or this has to be done. But this is a hint at how physically some of the techniques are there and that can be used. But if you really look at these are practices that are very common in concentration and mindfulness exercises too. And when one practices some of these things, it in general makes one better at concentration, better at being focused. But for a mumukshu, for someone who is after the higher goals in life, for a sadhaka, this is only part of the process. This does not complete the entire technique that one has to take. That's why in the next verse, Krishna continues. He says, Yataha indriyaha manobuddhihi. One who has the senses, mind and intellect control, moksha parayanaha, having liberation as his or her supreme goal. Which means using these techniques, once a person is able to withdraw the senses and the mind from the distractions of the outside world, what is one supposed to do with the mind, the buddhi and the senses? So that's what Krishna says here. Yataha indriya manobuddhihi. After having controlled the senses, mind and intellect, moksha parayanaha. One must have moksha or liberation as the goal that one is moving towards. And when one is able to do this, he or she, Krishna says, transcends ichcha or desire, bhaya, fear and krodha, anger. And such a person who has transcended ichcha, bhaya, krodha becomes yaha sada mukta eva saha. Such a person is a sada mukta, who is ever free. So in these final verses of the fifth chapter, Krishna hints that one needs necessarily some tools and techniques. Also, apart from having the resolve, apart from having taken to the path of Karma Yoga, one also needs some techniques by which one is able to control the mind. Of course, we will speak about it once we begin the next chapter. But that is how this last few verses become a precursor or an introductory hint at what is going to come in the sixth chapter. But the final verse of the fifth chapter is very different from whatever Krishna has been speaking so far. And it's a very beautiful verse where Krishna says, Bhoktaram yajna tapasam sarva loka maheshwaram sahridam sarva bhutanam nyatvama shanti mritchati. Bhoktaram yajna tapasam means enjoyer of all yajnas and tapas. Sarva loka maheshwaram, the master of the world. Suhridam sarva bhutanam, a friend to all beings. Krishna says, whoever knows me as all this, nyatva mam, whoever knows me as all of this, shanti mritchati, attains the supreme peace. So when Krishna says, yajna tapasam, bhuktaram yajna tapasam, he says, it means all acts that are done as an offering or as a sadhana. So when he says the one who knows me as the bhokta of all these yajnas and tapas, that is the highest nature of a devotee, because a devotee will always do whatever he does as an offering to God. And whatever he or she is supposed to do, he is supposed to do it considering what is it that will please the Lord. So when a person says, I'm not going to do activities that please me, but please the Lord, then the devotee is willfully giving up what we've been talking about as raga and dvesha, and starts wondering, what is the activity that I have to do to please the Lord? So in that manner, one removes oneself from the status of being the bhokta or the enjoyer, and places the Lord as the bhokta of all the activities. And that is the meaning of the word bhoktaram yajna tapasam nyatvama. One who acknowledges or considers me as the enjoyer of all those actions one is doing as an offering to me, one is doing as sadhana. That is one of the qualities of a devotee, and Krishna is referring to the highest quality of that devotee. So far we've seen Krishna describing a jnani, right? All of this from the second chapter when he spoke about the sthita prajna, later when he spoke about the jnani, when he was speaking about the sannyasi. All of these descriptions are the descriptions of a jnani, but he is doing it, especially in the fifth chapter, through the description of a true sannyasi and true karma yogi, or through the paths of sannyasa and karma yoga. And why was Krishna doing that? so that it makes it easy for a sadhaka to reach the state of a jnani through these disciplines. The disciplines are described, the person who has reached that state is described, so that these becomes pointers for a person who's trying to follow the path. So it becomes like you can act like this, you can think like this, you can meditate in this manner. So the same goal is now made accessible in this particular shloka to a devotee. So the devotee who considers Krishna clearly says, me, jnatva mam, he says. Which means in this shloka, again, Krishna speaks as Ishvara. As we've seen in many shlokas before, Krishna speaks in the form as somebody like a guru who is imparting knowledge which has been passed on to him. At certain points, Krishna assumes the stature of Ishvara. He says that I am the one who receives everything. I am the one on whom you have to concentrate. So this is a shloka where, as we can say, Krishna has shifted to the Ishvara mode, right? So he says, whoever knows me as the one who is the final enjoyer of everything, whoever knows me as the Supreme Lord, Sarva Bhute, the exact one, he says is Sarva Loke Loka Maheshwaram. In the shloka he says, Sarva Loka Maheshwaram and Sukhritam Sarva Bhutanam. Sukhrit means a friend, a well-wisher, which means when the devotee considers the Lord as a well-wisher, what happens in that state? Whatever happens in one's life becomes acceptable to that devotee, because the devotee says, I trust the Lord, I trust the Lord to be my best friend, and whatever he sends my way can only be beneficial to me. As Swami would say, whatever happens is good for me, whatever Swami gives me is good for me. And when that state is reached, that is the state that is described here, one who sees me as Suhrid, not only to me, not only to you, but to everyone. So the Lord is the one who is a benefactor or a well-wisher of everyone, right? So that is the state that is spoken here, and that is how the fifth chapter ends, right? The penultimate two verses of the chapter hints at what is going to come in the sixth chapter, but the chapter itself ends by including even the nature of a devotee, and we will see how all of this is tied up together. The sixth chapter that we're going to start today is called Dhyana Yoga. As the name suggests, Krishna is going to speak about meditation. But before I introduce the chapter, I think we'll go straight to the first shloka of the chapter. We'll listen to it and give you a brief meaning of that. And then we will discuss about it. In the means of that, we will also have an introduction to why all of a sudden dhyana is coming into the picture when Krishna is talking about karma yoga and sannyasa, especially sannyasa, because Arjuna had asked and keeps asking about why not sannyasa, right? So in the middle of that, suddenly Krishna chooses to speak about dhyana, and there is a good reason for that, and that we'll discuss about after we listen to the first verse of the sixth chapter. As always, it is rendered by Brother Shyam. We will listen to it, I'll give you a brief meaning, and then we'll take it on from there.
Anashrita karma phalam karyam karma karoti yaha sasanyasi cha yogi cha na niragnir na chakriyaha.
He who performs an action which is his duty without depending on the result of action, he is a monk and a yogi. But not he who does not keep a fire and is actionless. So that is the first verse in the sixth chapter, and with that we begin the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. I think the one thing that Krishna has established in all that he has said in the previous chapters is what happens inside of oneself matters more than what happens in the outside. Well, it is not that what we speak, what we do, and how we live is not important. It is definitely very significant, because that is the way we interact with the world. And in fact, Krishna is not allowing Arjuna to treat that external expression as trivial. That is why he is saying that this is your dharma, you have to do it, and doing it is more important, right? So we are talking about action, a physical expression. So it is not to say that that is not important. If what I do is not at all important, then why will Swami tell me do this and don't do this. If what I speak is not important at all, then why will Swami speak, Swami say, speak lovingly, speak the truth and all of such instructions we will never get from Swami. So definitely the external expression is very, very important. But what we are looking at here is based on, from whatever Krishna has been telling so far, based on how we speak, act, dress and make choices, people will tend to give us labels. And very often we tend to get carried away by those labels. And when people speak so highly of them, those external expressions tend to acquire a glamour of their own. We see this happening in every aspect of life, isn't it? A change in the order of things, so to say, or as they would say, putting the cart before the horse. That's what happens. Because there is something that is supposed to happen inside me, and that happening is supposed to be expressed in words and actions, and that expression may be admired by others or applauded or, more importantly, followed by others. But what is happening is we look at the external of others and we are trying to imitate them in a manner, so to say. And there is a positive and a negative to this. There is no doubt. That's why even in the second chapter we saw how Arjuna asks Krishna this question. He says, Sita Prajnasya Kaba Asha Samadhisthitasya Keshava Sthitadihi Kim Prabhasheta Kimasit Vachate Kim. O Keshava, what is the description of a Sthita Prajna who is self-absorbed? How does the man of a steady wisdom speak? How does he sit? How does he move about? And we've discussed many times how this is a very valid approach, trying to align one's actions to that of a wise person is a good sadhana in itself. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But for that, the sadhaka must have true sincerity. And that sincerity will make the sadhaka at some point in time dwell deeper into what is truly the attribute that he is trying to portray, what truly it means to be a Sthita Prajna. Just sitting like a Sthita Prajna, talking and acting like one, can never make one a Sthita Prajna. So if the sadhaka has the sincerity, at some point he or she will turn within and take to the right path. And as I said, we see this problem in everything in life. The other day when we were happened to be in a workshop, I was explaining this to some of the Sai youth. I am a student of Swami, but who should call me a Swami student? By virtue of being a graduate of the Satyasai Institute of High Learning, people might call me a Swami student. Because I dress, groom and carry myself in a certain manner, people call me a Swami student. The whole world might recognize me as a student of Swami, but truly speaking, all that is utterly useless to me, isn't it? What is most important is Swami should recognize me as his student. Isn't that the most important thing? And Swami is not one, we all know, who goes by external appearances. He is not a bahya priya. So if I truly have to be a Swami student, it has to be inside out. It doesn't matter if the whole world recognizes me as a Swami student. What is important to me is Swami must recognize me, and that Swami is seated in the heart. So even though how we speak, how we act is very important, and much of karma and duty constitutes that physical external expression, the most important shift must happen deep within. And that is why in the previous chapter, Krishna explained what is true sannyasa from the point of view of what happens inside. And karma yoga becomes something that harmonizes what happens within the person to the karma that is performed by the person outside. So karma is physical and yoga is a concept. It's an internal union. And for this, certain tools become necessary. And this chapter is going to discuss one such important tool. For a moment, just look at an average person, right? A person who is running a family, earning every day to keep things going, making decisions on a daily basis. Let's say who probably does a little bit of puja to overcome the uncertainties in life. if you live in India, praying becomes a very important part of life because we live with so many uncertainties, right? Because we are, you know, we are culturally oriented that way, that is definitely there. And also we have many uncertainties and the population is large and your opportunities are few to come by. So because of that, you know, the dependence on a force that is way above becomes a very natural trait. So just like how one tries to keep the boss and seniors in the workplace appeased, one ensures that God is also kept appeased, right? So in general, I'm trying to describe a person who does normal karma and who has a little bit of prayer, which becomes a part of the other karmas that one person does. Now, what is the mechanism of such a person? A simple person, I'm not talking any spirituality here. The person has some goals, which are based on his or her own likes and dislikes. And now these likes and dislikes tend to get further enhanced by the inputs from the outside world. Now, I'm not talking in a derogatory manner or trying to put down the idea of a simple worldly person. But if you look at someone like that, if I were to use pop language, the average Joe, right? They will probably just not be able to relate to the idea of karma yoga that we are talking about here. Why should I not be worried about the results? Right? Putting this idea in a person who is a regular person, a samsari, as it is said, a person who is caught up in this world, it is very difficult to answer and get this idea in that person's head. This has to come over a long period of time. Why should I not worry about the results of the actions that I am so diligently performing? What is wrong in liking something and what is wrong in pursuing what you like? Because for an ordinary person, what has to be achieved is right in front of that person. It's right in front of his or her eyes. And one is pursuing that. There's nothing wrong in that from the mentality of that person. And honestly speaking, it is not wrong. No, as long as that person is not taking to a wrong path or not harming others in the process of trying to achieve or pursue what one wants to pursue, there's nothing wrong in that. And that is why it would be very difficult to explain a person like that the idea of karma yoga or doing something in the physical world with something more than the physical world in mind, right? So for karma yoga, the person undergoes a change in paradigm itself. What is good enough for the worldly person is not good enough for the sadhaka. So the way the karma yogi approaches life is very, very different. Now the problem is the world's nature is different from this approach. And this difference in the world's approach has a very profound impact on the insides of the person too. And that is why it is called the ocean of samsara, the ocean of worldly life, because it has strong currents and waves and it is very difficult to resist and is very difficult to hold oneself back. So the karma yogi needs some means by which the insides can be protected from the outside. Right? I hope you're getting the drift of what I'm saying. So take a person who is very, very normal, and I'm sure if you look around, it's very easy to find somebody, a very good person, right? I'm not even talking about somebody who is crooked or somebody who is immoral. A normal person, right? It's very difficult to tell that person, do whatever you're doing, but don't have any expectations from that. Take care of your children, but don't have expectations from them. Be detached from your family. These are concepts which takes lifetimes to become a part of one's thinking, right? So that is why some of us should be grateful that Swami has even allowed us to think in these manners, right? Think that there is something more than what the world has to offer. There's something more. There's a joy that is deeper. There's a happiness that is more supreme. There's a peace that is more supreme. And you're able to at least visualize that as a goal. That itself is a blessing, right? That's why they say, manushyatvam mumukshatvam mahapurusha samshaya. To be born as a human being itself is a great blessing. After having been born as a human being, if you have mumukshatvam, a desire for something more than what this world can offer, it's a blessing. It does not come easily, right? So if you are a spiritual person, I'm not saying be very proud of that, but we be very grateful for that. And having received this gift, I think it's very important to work on that. And of course, Mahapurusha Samshraya is a very, very important and an added benefit, right? You have the craving, for something higher, but you also have the guidance of a person who is able to take you there. That becomes a great boon in itself. So going back to this idea, and when you put a karma yogi in this world, when you put a karma yogi in the midst of people who are constantly pursuing whatever they want to pursue, the karma yogi now needs some means by which he can preserve this ideas that he has, the resolves that he has kept for himself, the focus that he is trying to make, the goal that he is trying to keep in front of his eyes. He needs some means by which he is able to isolate or insulate his inside from the outside. So till now, Krishna has spoken about what should be the nature of a karma yogi. And he has done it by speaking directly or speaking about jnani, right? That's what we've seen in the entire fifth chapter. And he will be doing that in many parts of the Bhagavad Gita later too. But the challenge for the karma yogi is he cannot run away from the outside world. He or she cannot run away from one's duties. Let's say if a karma yogi becomes a CEO, he will still have to work with profits, sale figures, hiring and firing employees, and day-to-day managing the employees under him. He does not have the luxury or privilege of going away to seclusion into the Himalayas. So the karma yogi needs some tools to maintain this inner focus and remain a yogi and not be pulled into samsara. So in this chapter, Krishna is going to speak about one such tool, and that is dhyana or meditation. Let me give you another example to make this idea a little more accessible to our understanding. We as Swami students always used to wear whites, right? Swami liked that we dress in whites, so that eventually became the uniform for the students of the university. Now the world, with all its dust and dirt, will not treat me differently just because I'm wearing whites, right? The world will not say, oh, Papam, this person is wearing white clothes, let me not dirty him or let me not settle on him. No, it will soil the cloth just as same. If it's a white cloth, black cloth, red or a blue or whatever it is, it will be soiled in the same way, right? But now if I choose to wear whites, apart from making up my mind that I want to start wearing whites, or Swami likes whites, so let me start wearing white clothes, apart from taking that resolve, I must also come up with some strategies or some techniques or some processes by which I can continue to wear whites, right? Maybe I'll have to wash my clothes more often or have more pairs. You know, some of us, when we were in the hostel, we used to do this. We used to have separate sets of whites. One set of whites we used to use only for the college, because we used to go into the lab and it's almost impossible to keep your whites clean. And then we would have one set of whites which we would wear only to Mandir, so that when we present ourselves before Swami, we would be in our best whites, right? So that way we had to come up with strategies so that this resolve that we've taken of wearing this kind of clothes can be maintained, right? So in the same manner, a karma yogi may take a resolve to live life in a certain manner, but he or she also needs some tools and strategies to maintain that resolve even while one is living in the world. And in that context, Krishna is going to speak about meditation. And this is very, very important to remember, the context in which Krishna is speaking about meditation. That's why I'm spending a little bit of time on this. It's important to understand why and where this concept of meditation is coming from. Because many people, you know, think that there are different chapters in the Gita. Each chapter speaks about a different concept. One place Krishna speaks about karma, the other place Krishna speaks about jnana, at one place Krishna speaks about dhyana, and then later he speaks about bhakti. And each of the time Krishna speaks of that being the most supreme path. So a lot of people would say this, that Gita is self-contradictory. Just now Krishna spoke about not being a sannyasi and being a karma yogi. Then he is now speaking about dhyana, and you always kind of associate meditation with a recluse, right? You associate meditation with monks. So Krishna's praising Karma Yoga in one chapter and then praising Dhyana in the next one, it seems like the discourse is self-contradictory. But that is not true. Krishna is not going to speak of Dhyana as a path. We must keep this in mind that Dhyana is going to be spoken of as a technique, as a tool for the Karma Yogi. The underlying theme of the entire Bhagavad Gita in that sense is Karma Yoga, that one has to perform actions that one has to. And having that in mind, I think it is good to go into this chapter and understand what Krishna is trying to tell here, right? So just to quickly tell you what I am trying to say, when you talk about a sannyasi, a Karma Yogi, both have the same goal, right? That's one of the points that Krishna had said in the beginning. Both of them are pursuing the same thing. They are looking for one of the words that Krishna uses, Brahma Nirvanam, right? So both have the same goal. What does the sannyasi do? Sannyasi removes oneself from the samsara world and is able to concentrate on whatever he is supposed to do. But a Karma Yogi has to remain in the world. The Karma Yogi has to act in the world. Whatever is the role that is given to him, be it a husband, be it a wife, be it a mother, be it a daughter or son, he or she is supposed to perform all of those tasks. So they've put their hand into the slush, right? So to say. So the karma has to be performed in the world. But what is inside the Karma Yogi is completely contrary to the nature of the world. So one needs some techniques by which one is able to preserve this focus that is inside, and Dhyana is going to be spoken of as one of the techniques for that. Now coming to the first verse that we just heard. Krishna says, Yaha, whoever, anashritaha, without depending on, karma phalam, the fruit of action, karyam karma karoti, performs actions, that is one's duty. So Krishna is speaking about a person who is performing one's duty, whatever one has been asked to do, doing it anashritaha, without depending on karma phalam, the fruits of actions. So that is precisely a one-line definition of a Karma Yogi, right? Do what is your duty, what ought to be done, and do it without any expectations. If you look at it, just this statement, even though I said that that's a one-line definition of a Karma Yogi, this statement actually applies very much even to a sannyasi, isn't it? If one becomes a sannyasi, then his or her duties will change accordingly, right? One might have to pray, let us say one might have to pray for everyone. And these are concepts which are there in, I think, all religions. You know, either one becomes a monk or one becomes a nun. Then the roles and responsibilities of that person changes accordingly. There are a new set of duties. Now you're not taking care of your family or taking care of someone else. As one of the monks in the Ramakrishna order was once saying, that he took up to sannyasa now, at a very young age, I think maybe in his 20s or early 30s, and the moment he became a sannyasi, there was a time where he was given a little time to get himself accustomed to the ashram, and then he was said that now you go and take care of this hostel of school boys. And he ended up there and he found that this hostel had about 40 students, and he started telling that, you know, had I been in the worldly path, had I been a samsari, I would have had two children to take care of. And here I became a monk and now I have to take care of 40 children, right? So even when one becomes a sannyasi, one gets a new set of duties and roles and responsibilities, right? So if you look at it from that point of view, those duties must now be performed without any expectations. So this statement that Krishna is making here, anashritaha karma phalam karyam karma karoti yaha, one who performs the mandated duty without placing one's hopes and happiness on the results, this statement applies as much to a Karma Yogi as it applies to a monk, a nun, or a sannyasi. Then he says, Sir, he, sannyasi cha yogi cha. He is a sannyasi and a karma yogi, sa sannyasi cha yogi cha, na niragnihi, not a niragni. Now this word niragni is a term that is often used to describe a monk. The scriptures say that a householder must always do the fire sacrifice, right, a yajna. That is one of the, what is referred to as a naimittika karma of a householder. That is, for every occasion, the different occasions for which the fire sacrifice is prescribed. At the time of marriage, one is supposed to do a fire sacrifice. During the naming ceremony of a child, there's a fire sacrifice. When house is built, one has to do a fire sacrifice. So these are called naimittika karmas. For occasions, for specific occasions, there are certain rituals that are mandated. So when one becomes a householder, one becomes bound to do some of these fire sacrifices. So one who does not have to do these fire sacrifices is referred to as a niragni, somebody who does not have this obligation to perform fire sacrifices. So Krishna says, sa sannyasi cha yogi cha. He is a sannyasi and a karma yogi. Who is it? The definition that Krishna had given in the first statement. That is, someone who is doing whatever is the mandated duty without any desire for the fruits thereof. So he is a sannyasi and a yogi, na niragni, not somebody who has just become a sannyasi by not performing the fire sacrifices. Niragnihi. And then Krishna says, nacha akriyaha, and not an akriya. Akriya again is another name that is used for someone who has renounced one's kriyas or one's duties. So Krishna says, a person who performs what one ought to do without expectations of any kind, sa sannyasi cha yogi cha, he is the true sannyasi, he is the true karma yogi too. Na niragnir na cha akriyaha, not the one who has simply given up rituals and who has simply given up duties. Right? So Krishna has explained just this in the previous chapter. Merely by wearing an ochre robe, you're not a sannyasi. By going to the forest, you're not a sannyasi. By calling yourself a swamiji or changing your name and begging for your daily food, you don't become a sannyasi. You become a true sannyasi only when this shift happens inside of you. And what is that shift? I don't work to fulfill my desires. I work to fulfill my duties. Right? That is the one line definition of what has to happen to us. I don't work to fulfill my desires. I work to fulfill my duties. So clearly, what is important, as I said right in the beginning, is what is inside. And then how what is inside is eventually expressed outside becomes what is important next. So this is true not just for a sannyasi wearing ochre, this is true even for a karma yogi, right? There may be a person who is very sincere in whatever he is doing, very diligent in their duties, very meticulous. They may be providing for their family, they might be an ideal mother, ideal father, a great daughter, a great son. But merely doing duties perfectly and diligently does not make one a karma yogi. A karma yogi should be a moksha parayana. There should be moksha as the goal. Whatever one is doing, that must be the goal of the person, and that's what makes one a karma yogi, right? There's this very beautiful portion in towards the end of Prema Vahini, where Swami makes a very profound point. He says, people say manava seva is madhava seva. Service to man is service to God. Swami says, it is true, the statement is very true, no doubt. But if service is done to man without contemplation on God, without the faith that God is in the man that one is serving, then this statement, manava seva is madhava seva, will remain merely a statement. You might do the greatest of seva, but it will remain only manava seva. So Swami says, the acknowledgement of God is what makes seva madhava seva. In the same way, merely by me being sincere and diligent in duty does not make me a karma yogi. A karma yogi must be one who offers one's actions to God. And because of that, He is sincere, and because of that, he is not bothered about the results. And because of that, he focuses only on the bounden duty of the moment. Anashritaha karmaphalam karyam karma karotiyaha. He does it. He does what he is supposed to do at that moment without being bothered about what is going to come thereof, right? So that is what Krishna is saying. It's a summary of whatever Krishna has been telling all this while. But it's a very beautiful point that is being made here. Krishna started off the fifth chapter by saying that there is no difference between a karma yogi and a sannyasi, right? These are different pathways, you're just giving them different names. They are the same. So here, in a sense, Krishna is again reiterating, how is it they become the same? Because you are only looking at what is outside. You are only looking at whether the person is in the palace or whether the person is in the forest, whether the person is wearing royal garments or whether the person is sitting in, wearing simple ochre clothes. You're seeing whether the person is lifting a bow to fight or whether the person is having a rosary in his hands. And all our understanding is based on only what one sees. But Krishna is saying what makes one a karma yogi, what makes one a sannyasi is what happens inside. As I just said, I don't work to fulfill my desires, I work to fulfill my duties. That should be the catchphrase that rings in one's mind. And then it doesn't matter whether one becomes a karma yogi or a sannyasi. That becomes, it's not at all a matter of importance, as Krishna is going to say in the next verse. So we listen to the second verse. I'll give you a brief meaning of that. We'll talk briefly about it. I think with that we'll conclude this week's episode.
Yam sanyasamiti prahuhu yogam tam vidhi pandava nahya sanyasta sankalpo yogi bhavati kashchana.
That which they call sannyasa, know that to be karma yoga, O Pandava. For nobody who has not given up thoughts or aspirations can ever be a yogi. That's the second verse, and as we were seeing in the previous shloka, Krishna mentions what the karma yogi and the sannyasi will have to do. Whatever is the prescribed duty in the path chosen, one must perform it. And when one performs it without expectations. In this shloka, Krishna describes the mental state of that person. Generally, we tend to think that only a sannyasi has to sacrifice desires and ambitions and lead a simple life, right? But what is a sannyasi trying to do really? Through changes in the external behavior and lifestyle, the sannyasi is trying to bring about an attitude of renunciation in the mind, right? That's what sannyasa is all about. One tries to give up expensive clothing, one tries to give up comfortable accommodations. One is trying to do something in the outside so that there is a renunciation. The attitude of renunciation comes in the inside. And apparently, when Swami had used to go around to Rishikesh and Himalayas and meet a lot of sannyasis, used to meet a lot of monks who used to come to Swami. I think there was the Sadhu Parishad, which was, I'm not too sure of the year, maybe early 80s or even much before that. So a lot of these Swamijis would come to Swami, and Swami would travel, and Swami would visit some of these Swamijis. One of the advice that Swami would constantly give them is, you know, you have taken up sannyas, you have given up the worldly life, but now look at you. You are so lost in the administration of your ashrams. You're wondering how much donations are coming and how much are we cooking? Are the people being fed? Are crowds coming? So Swami is saying that the whole idea is being lost. You were trying to renounce something so that the renunciation comes in your mind. But now look at you. Is there renunciation in your mind? Right? Of course, this is not to generalize the life of all monks, but this is quite relatable, right? Forget about taking up something as rigorous as sannyasa. It can be said of someone like us living in the ashram too. In fact, Swami himself would say this to the ashram residents. Every now and then, Swami would call the residents, the permanent residents of the ashram, into the bhajan hall, bhajan mandir in Prashant Nilayam, and Swami would give them a discourse. And one of the things that Swami would often tell them is this: you know, you all have come here, you've come away from the pulls of your world, you've left your relatives, you've left all your family, and you've come here. What is the point if after coming to the ashram, you still end up making friends and getting attached to each other? Or one begins to lose track and again gets into the same struggle for power and name and fame and authority and all of that, right? Only in the ashram, the form of in the ashram or in the forest or in a setup like that, the struggle has changed, but the struggle remains. But the mentality is the same. One is probably not running after a job which is going to pay one heavily, but one is still running after power and authority. One may not be attached to one's cousins and aunts and uncles, but one starts getting attached to the neighbor, or one gets attached to the person who is sitting next to you in the mandir, right? So Swami would always keep reminding people that it is not about where you are sitting, it is about what is happening inside you. Which means one has removed oneself from samsara physically, but one may not have removed samsara from the mind. A true sannyasi must renounce samsara in the mind. And Krishna reminds us that in this particular shloka. He says, yam sannyasam iti prahu. What is referred to as sannyasa, yogam tam viddhi pandava. O Pandava, O Arjuna, understand that to be karma yoga. Because if you are a sannyasi or a karma yogi, what has to be renounced is the same. It doesn't matter. So Krishna is saying, what is spoken of as sannyasa, what is spoken of as renunciation, that is karma yoga, what I'm trying to teach you. So what is spoken of as karma yoga, that is sannyasa, that is often spoken of, right? So Krishna is clearly stating that there is no difference between the two. So what is it that has to be given up? What is it that has to be renounced? Krishna answers that by saying, who is not a karma yogi, and hence that person cannot be a sannyasi too. He says in the next line, he says, asanyasta sankalpaha. One who has not renounced thoughts. Asanyasta. One who has not renounced sankalpaha, thoughts. Krishna uses the word sankalpa, though fundamentally the word sankalpa means thoughts. The context it is used in this particular verse is more of aspirations or desires. I want name and fame. I would like to achieve this. I would like to be known as such and such a person. All of these are sankalpas, right? They are desires and ambitions, fears and worries. All of these start with sankalpas in the mind, right? I just think of something, and as Krishna said in the third chapter, I think, Dhyayate Vishayan Pumsa, what comes as a thought then becomes a contemplation. The mind starts rotating around it, right? So everything starts with the sankalpa and then becomes all of these pulls and pushes of the world. So in this context, it refers to such thoughts that eventually become raga and dvesha, that is likes and dislikes, and eventually start driving us into action. So Krishna says, asanyasta sankalpaha. One who has not renounced these sankalpas. Na yogi bhavati kaschana, can never be a yogi. So Krishna is beautifully drawing a parallel or a line that connects sannyasa with yoga. He's saying, yes, even a yogi needs sannyasa. What is the sannyasa the yogi needs? The sannyasa of the sankalpas. And then Krishna says, what is referred to as sannyasa is nothing but karma yoga, which means what a sannyasi is supposed to renounce and what a karma yogi is supposed to renounce is one and the same. The sankalpas have to be renounced, right? So these two verses in that sense are an extension of the fifth chapter, but I wouldn't again call it repetition, because in so many different ways, in so many beautiful ways, Krishna is conveying the same important thing, and this is very, very important. I think we should not consider these as repetitions, because as I said, Shravana, Manana and Nididhyasana is itself a means by which we are protecting the inside from the outside. whatever is happening in the outside world, we are living in the world. We are living, you know, I finished this program, I'm going to go back. I'm again into that world, right? For this 1 hour, probably not even once I've thought about what's happening in the world outside. And we all know what is happening. I'm sure most of you are stuck at home, right? But for this 1 hour, I've not been able to think of what is happening in the world. What is the news? What is the latest statistics? So what I've heard or what I've spoken to all of you might have been a repetition. But through this process, we have maintained this inner focus. We have maintained our inner world from being affected from the outside world. And that is what is the most important thing, right? And that tool, one of those tools, is what Krishna is going to speak about in the form of dhyana. And that is why these are all connected. One wants to be a karma yogi, one has to do karma. Where does one do karma? One has to do karma in the world. How does one go into the world without the world affecting one? One needs some means by which the focus is always maintained, right? In fact, I'll probably end with a very beautiful quote that I don't know whether we read it out this morning or we were about to read it out this morning. It's part of the conversations that Swami has with Hislop, where Swami says, without concentration, nothing can be done. And we use that concentration throughout the day. Why is that same concentration so difficult to come by in spiritual matters? But the mind can be trained to concentrate inwardly, and the heart can be cultured to grow with love for God. How? By means of sadhana. The best sadhana is that every act through the day be done as worship of God. It's a very beautiful quote, because till now I've been speaking of meditation as a tool, right? So that the inside can be protected from the influences of the outside. But here Swami is saying that the act of doing whatever you do as a worship for God, which is the basis of karma yoga, that being the tool for meditation itself, right? So you can see that beautiful, how one complements the other, and Swami is hinting at that. So it's very important as we go into this chapter on Dhyana Yoga to understand it as a tool. That's another point that Swami was making in the satsang that we are having this morning. Swami was saying that you talk of pranayama, pratyahara, dhyana, dharana, samadhi, all of that. You cannot pull out these and speak of them out of the context. These are all different tools, different pathways, different steps in that goal towards the ultimate. Right? So dhyana also has to be looked up as that. And that is what we're going to speak about. But what would happen, as you'll see in many of these chapters, is when Krishna speaks about that, the Bhagavad Gita is not merely a discourse to Arjuna. Bhagavad Gita is also a way by which Krishna is speaking about all of those valid techniques. I think we had discussed this even when we were going through the third or fourth chapter, when Krishna speaks about pranayama. I think it's in the fourth chapter. Many of the valid techniques get a reference in the Gita, because these are all timeless techniques. These were useful, even the Dwapara Yuga, these were useful in the Treta Yuga. They are very, very useful in the Kali Yuga too. So sometimes when Krishna is speaking about a certain topic, he dwells deeper into it because of the relevance that topic has for us. But even as we go through it, it is important to see the basis of all of this is, how do I be a karma yogi? How do I continue to do my duties but not be affected by them? How do I continue to do whatever role I am assigned, but I am able to do it only as appointed by Swami there? I am doing Swami's work. You might be working in a multinational company. I might be working at Radio Sai. But our attitude should be the same. I am working for Swami. Whatever I am doing is my offering to my Swami, right? So that is the basis of the entire Gita. Everything else adds to that. Sannyasa was spoken of from that point of view. Krishna spoke about jnana, advaita from that point of view. Krishna is going to speak in the future about bhakti from that point of view, because without bhakti there's no karma yoga at all. So all of that is spoken to bolster this idea of how do we do work as worship? How do we lead life by the dictum, duty is God, right? So with that, dear listeners, I'll conclude this week's episode. Thank you again for joining me. I'll join you all again next week, as I said, not at 7:30, but 7:45 p.m. for the continuation of the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. I most humbly offer this at Swami's lotus feet. After this program, I'm going to be playing for you a talk that Brother Bishu has given. The title of the talk, the theme of the talk is Sadhana, the Inward Path. So pretty much a continuation of whatever we've been speaking. I'm sure that's a very enlightening talk. I hope you'll stay on to listen to it and enjoy to that. Till I meet you all next week, keep safe, stay at home, and take good care of yourself. Till I meet you all next week, Jai Sai Ram.